Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-1234, Verizon California, Inc. et al. Petitioners versus Federal Communication Commission et al. Mr. Kellogg for the petitioners, Mr. Carr for the respondents, and Mr. Varelli for the interveners.
Good morning, Mr. Kellogg.
Chief Judge Chantel, may it please the court. I'd like to begin by making 3 points regarding the language of Section 222B, which is set forth at page 2 of the addendum of our brief. First, in order to come within Section 222B, Verizon would have to be using information that a customer wants to disconnect and port his or her number to provide a telecommunications service. The key words in 222B are shall use such information only for such purpose. The subject of that clause is clearly the carrier receiving the information, and that receiving carrier is to use the information only for such purpose, that is, for the purpose of providing any telecommunications service. So the telecommunications carrier receiving the information has to be providing the service. The sentence makes no sense otherwise. Now, the FCC's reading, which is that the carrier providing the information is also providing the telecommunications service, is plainly wrong. It requires the FCC to add language in brackets, and it completely changes the meaning of the provision. It's also unsupported by any of the prior FCC decisions construing this provision, all of which assume that the carrier receiving the information is providing the service.
But they have a variant reading.
I'm sorry?
They have a different reading as well.
They right? do. In the alternative, they say that, okay, even if you are the carrier that providing the that has to be providing the telecommunications service, you are providing a telecommunications service to the requesting carrier, to the carrier giving you the port and disconnect information. But Verizon provides no telecommunications service to that other carrier.
That's the issue, right, isn't it?
Well, under their alternative reading, it is their issue. And
so the question is, under Chevron, why isn't that, why isn't the commission free to characterize that as a telecommunications service?
Well, telecommunications service, the term is defined in the statute. It's specifically providing telecommunications for a fee. We are not providing, when Comcast or another carrier comes to us and says, okay, port this number and disconnect that customer, we are not providing any telecommunications service to that customer. Now, the FCC tries to say, well, it's adjunct to or otherwise subsidiary to a telecommunications service, but that's to a service that we're providing to our own customer. Interveners recognize that the FCC's reading is untenable, and so they try to argue that, well, the telecommunications service we're providing is to our own customer. But that's not what the FCC argued.
And yes, in addition, it seems to in its brief, on page 32 of its brief, it seems to move in that direction. But
it,
then
it does seem to.
When you look at what it cites, it seems a questionable move.
I think more than questionable. I think it's quite clear that the FCC is arguing differently in the order. Moreover, that position actually lands them in hotter water, because it's a recognition of the fact that we only receive this information about the disconnect and the port as part of our retail service that we're providing to the customer.
Well, there are terrific problems of characterization here, right? And I guess you have to show that it's not within the flexibility that Chevron offers the commission to characterize this activity as part of telecommunications service provided by Verizon to the competing carrier.
But they cannot identify any telecommunications service that we're providing to
the competing carrier. Well, I mean, at least maybe I don't understand their argument. That's entirely possible. But if I do, what I take it to be is this is a component of the totality of telecommunications service, and therefore that they're free to characterize it as a telecommunications service.
Well, right, but the service has to be provided to somebody. And the service
their answer is, at least the order's answer, but only in part the briefs, is to the competing carrier. Right? So, I mean, and it...
Well, they're claiming that we provide the port
to the
other carrier.
Right.
But the port itself is not a telecommunications service. And if it's adjunct to a service, it's adjunct to the service, as the interveners themselves recognize, that we provide to our own retail customers, which is part of the point that the information at issue here, the disconnect order and the port request, is information that we get as part of our retail service to our own customer. It can't be proprietary vis-a-vis us within the meaning of Section 222B, because it's information that we have to get from our own customer, and the FCC is conceded.
Yeah, but I mean, the difficulty with that is that it can be proprietary and subject to disclosure under limited conditions, right? I mean, I forget whether it's the intervener brief or the commission's brief, which points to the example of protective orders where information is disclosed for broader purposes, but subject to limitations.
And even in that context, of course, you still have a First Amendment consideration. You still have to pass, as this court has indicated in the FEC case, you still have to pass intermediate scrutiny, which influences how you apply the Chevron test. But without even getting there, I don't think the government, without even putting the First Amendment thumb on the scales, I don't think the government can pass either Chevron 1 or Chevron 2 in this case. If you look at their rationale, for example, of why they think it's okay to distort the language in this way, what they're saying is we have a policy in favor of facilities-based competition, and this restriction is going to promote facilities-based competition.
That's not entirely fair. Characterization. I mean, they say that the statute clearly mandates this rule in the context of unbundled service and so forth. And then they go on to say, so why should we draw a distinction against the kind of service that we really want to promote and Congress wanted to promote? That seems to me a powerful argument.
Two responses.
I mean, assuming, as I guess we have to assume, that the statute is coherent in its sort of basic central function.
A couple of responses to that. I agree the statute is coherent, and if you look at the structure of the statute, you'll see that 222B refers to information that we receive from other carriers. 222C refers to CPNI, information about our own retail customers. Now, the FCC has acknowledged that we are allowed to use CPNI in retention marketing. What 222B is designed to deal with is a quite different situation, where a carrier is coming to us in our wholesale capacity, as you noted, to get resale or unbundled elements, and in that capacity is asking us to provide a telecommunications service to them
that we're
required.
That's clearly the heartland of the provision. There's no doubt about that. But they seem to be saying, this is outside the heartland, but since the policy is perhaps even stronger here, this is a reasonable interpretation.
Well, it's very important to note, as you do, that this is outside the heartland.
Yeah.
They're trying to extend a policy developed in a different context. And the evidence before the FCC in this context was that there were unalloyed consumer benefits of allowing Verizon to engage in retention marketing, that there were as much as $75 million in immediate consumer benefits, and the FCC did not dispute that. Instead, it said, well, long-term, it may dampen the incentive of the cable industry to themselves try to gain customers, when, in fact, the record shows they're gaining about just two of the clients here, Comcast and Time Warner, are gaining 60,000 a week from us.
Is that the only pro-competitive notion that the commission is relying on? I had some difficulty figuring out what their pro-competitive notion is. But the notion is that competition by the incumbent will make competition from the competitor less likely.
That seems to be their theory, which is contrary to economic sense. It's contrary to the evidence. It's contrary to Congress's intent. And it's also contrary to the First Amendment to suggest that customers should be denied information that's going to allow them to get cheaper service if they stay where they are rather than they change. What the FCC wants to do is lock people in to a change. They think that's going to be somehow pro-competitive, that once you win the customer, that they're locked into that until the change goes through. But in fact, the undisputed evidence in the record is that customers benefit and get a better deal if Verizon is allowed to engage in retention marketing. So not only is this outside the scope of any of the prior orders about 222B, not only does it distort the language of the provision, but it actually harms consumers. And hence, under the First Amendment commercial speech issues, it cannot constitute a substantial interest to justify this sort of restriction on speech.
The argument, which is somewhat different, which is used by the intervener, is sort of a you can't serve two masters argument, or that the, and it's alluded to by the commission too, and that is that if Verizon can do this, it's in a conflicted position, and it won't carry out its LNP mission the way it's supposed to, as briskly and promptly. And we'll have some questions for the intervener counsel on that issue, but what would you say to that?
Well, first of all, if you look at the statement of stipulated facts in this at Joint Appendix 272, it states that Verizon does not delay the porting of numbers in order to engage in retention marketing. So that issue is off the table, at least in the context of this particular complaint.
I'm sorry, 272.
Joint Appendix 272.
Yep. I'm there.
I'm sorry, I didn't have it in front of me in the actual paragraph.
Oh, it does not have a practice of delay.
Yes. I see. And in addition to that, of course, it's within the FCC's own authority to set the rules it wants governing the porting process. If it says it's got to happen faster or otherwise, or there are sanctions for delaying it, they're perfectly welcome to do that. But there's no suggestion here, no issue about our intervening in that process. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Okay, seeing no questions, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is James Carr. I represent the Federal Communications Commission. Verizon concedes that Section 222B applies in a situation where a competitor is requesting unbundled network elements. Now, if you think about that for a moment, if Verizon is providing unbundled network elements, that's not a transmission service. So, by Mr. Kellogg's lights, that's not a telecommunications service. It's a facility that could be used by the competing carrier to provide telecommunications service. So if Verizon is correct that this statute applies when a requester seeks unbundled network elements, then it applies either because the unbundled network elements are adjunct to some telecommunications service, and Verizon is providing an adjunct to basic service, or because the requesting carrier is the one providing telecommunications service. This is consistent with the reading the FCC has adopted here in this case. And, of course, if this statute applies to unbundled network elements, then surely it must apply when facilities-based carriers are involved.
Surely as a matter of policy, perhaps.
As a matter of policy, there's no doubt, Your Honor.
That logically necessarily follows. If it applies to the one, it applies to the other. I lost a step in.
Well, I'm saying my point is that this court has recognized repeatedly, as you're intimately familiar with the decisions in USTA 1 and USTA 2, Judge Williams, the uni-based competitors, the court and Verizon have repeatedly characterized as synthetic competitors. The primary purpose of the statute is to promote what Judge Williams called in USTA 2 genuine facilities-based competition. And Judge Sentelle, you followed with your COVAD decision in 2006, where you emphasized the same points. The primary purpose of this statute is to promote facilities-based competition.
I'm not sure how you're getting compared to the interpretation being required.
Well,
in
this case, you have carriers who are requesting a service so that they can provide telecommunications service on a competitive basis using their own facilities. These are the facilities-based competitors, Comcast, Time Warner, Bright House, that Congress had in mind when it passed the 1996 Act. And basically, if unbundled network elements users are covered by this, if their proprietary information is protected, then so too is the proprietary information of these facilities-based competitors.
Let's not talk for a minute about the purpose of the statute and just the language.
That would be fine,
Your Honor.
It says a telecommunications carrier, that's Verizon here, right, that receives or obtains proprietary information from another carrier.
Yes, Your Honor.
For purposes of providing any telecommunications service. Now, for purpose, there's only one subject in that sentence. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And this phrase refers back to that subject.
Yes.
And as Mr. Kellogg pointed out, the only way the commission produce a different interpretation of that statute, which it does at paragraph 31, is by adding language to the statute. It says, you know what I'm talking about, paragraph 31, where it has the bracketed statute? You want to get that out?
That's actually
21.
I don't think that's
21.
31, that's 21,
21.
Your Honor, yes.
Sorry.
No problem.
Okay, it says when Verizon receives or obtains proprietary information from, and then it adds, bracket,
a competitive carrier.
Now, that's not in the statute.
Well, what is in the statute is that another carrier. So I think the problem you're concerned with is in the next clause, for purposes of the competitive carrier providing any telecommunications service. And I think your concern is that's adding words, right?
The competitive carriers
are the ones providing telecommunications service.
Right.
That's right.
That's what's been added.
Keep in mind, it says providing any telecommunications service. When Verizon provides number porting, it is acting in a way that is for purposes of providing a telecommunications service.
To whom?
In the sense that
to whom?
Well, it is enabling the competitive carrier to provide a telecommunications service. The information was submitted by the competitive carrier so that it could provide telecommunications service. That's true in the unbundled network elements context, which is what I mentioned initially, and it's true here as well.
But the statute refers to the telecommunications carrier providing its telecommunications service.
Well,
not somebody else's.
It's ambiguous, Your Honor. I would.
Well,
argue.
That's the issue here.
It says for purposes.
I don't see that's
right.
I don't see the ambiguity. I mean, just in terms of sentence structure, there's really no way that this sentence, that this phrase, for purposes of providing any telecommunication service, can refer to anything other than the subject of the sentence, namely, the telecommunications carrier. I just don't see the ambiguity there.
Well, and I would argue that what that when the information is submitted, Verizon is using the information for purposes of providing a service in the sense that it's enabling
so
the competitive carrier to provide the telecommunications service.
I understand
service.
That, but I don't see that the statute says that.
I would point out also, Your Honor, that Verizon's alternative interpretation adds words to the statute as well. Uh-huh. They keep talking about page 14 of their reply brief, for purposes of providing any telecommunication service to the submitting carrier. There's no indication in the statute that this has to be some sort of a wholesale service.
Is that necessary to their argument?
No, it's not.
They can leave out that.
They can if they want. I think my only point is that what they're arguing.
Essentially necessary to the commission's position.
What they're arguing is that this is some sort of Chevron 1 situation, and it can't be if they're reading additional language into the statute. We would argue that
this
is a Chevron 2 case.
They can make their argument without reading additional language in, can't they?
They can. That's right, Your Honor, and I don't disagree with that, but I just wanted to point out even they have to concede that it's ambiguous because they're adding words to the statute as well.
Can we go back a second? Have you just argued that even in what I call the Kellogg agreed, the Heartland case,
yes,
the statute has to be read as providing, it's really enabling somebody else's telecommunications service. So, I seem to be arguing that the reading that perhaps all three of us agree on doesn't exist at all.
No.
Even
and I don't
know
with
the use of the statute. No.
No, I wasn't. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can you run that by me again? You said the Heartland.
The purposes of providing any telecommunication service, and I thought I heard you say, but maybe I didn't.
Well,
hear rightly, you were saying that even in the unbundled elements situation, which I think is the core situation, the receiving carrier was not actually providing any telecommunication service.
The receiving carrier is providing an adjunct to basic service in that context. That would be the alternative.
So
the alternative argument
is that in its core application, it requires a little gloss.
It does require a little gloss. If it doesn't, you don't necessarily have to accept the argument that the submitting carrier is the one providing the telecommunications service to uphold the commission here, because the receiving carrier is also providing an adjunct to basic telecommunications service. Number porting in this case, like unbundled network elements in the alternative case, is an essential component to a service. And it's the service that Verizon provides under its interconnection agreements with these complainants, services involving routing, switching, transmission. And Verizon acknowledges that it's also adjunct to the service that it provides on a retail basis to its customers.
What's the basis for concluding that the phrase, quote, telecommunication services includes things that the commission acknowledges are not telecommunication services?
Well, Your Honor, the background of the definition of telecommunication service, telecommunication service and information service, those two definitions were essentially adopted to track the commission's dichotomy between basic and enhanced services in the computer inquiry cases. The Supreme Court mm-hmm. found in the Brand X case that these were continuations of the same basic service distinctions. And the FCC for years has adopted this adjunct to basic.
Right, but I'm just asking you where it comes from in the statute. Because in other parts of the statute of the Act, when Congress wanted to include wanted to include other services in the definition, it used the phrase incidental too, whereas it didn't do that here.
I understand that, Your Honor. I think if you look at the background of how these definitions evolved and how they came from the Commission's longstanding interpretation under the computer inquiries, the division between basic and enhanced, and Congress was obviously aware of that.
Are you talking about
history.
These cases that are cited in paragraph 31?
Yes.
Central office
space okay. for co-location.
Okay, so
I looked,
at least for two of those categories, I looked at the statute that was in effect at the time, and in two of them, the statute in effect at the time defined communications by wire as all instrumentalities, facilities, apparatus, and services incidental to transmission.
That's right, Your Honor.
And that language isn't in this statute.
Well, it remains in the statute. There is a separate statutory definition of communication by wire that still has that language in the Communications Act.
I thought you conceded that porting was not a telecommunication service, that it was adjunct to it. Right?
It's adjunct to a basic service,
yeah.
And therefore it can be has been and can be regulated as a telecommunications service.
Okay, say to me once again now, what's the best authority you have for the proposition that under this statute, which defines telecommunications in the way it does, that the Commission can include under it services that are not telecommunications?
I would say it's the underlying history of the computer inquiries and the fact that the Supreme Court in Brand X found that these definitions of telecommunications service and information service were meant to track basic and enhanced services, and the adjunct to basic doctrine is simply a part of that longstanding regulatory history.
You have nothing where this statute doesn't use the language that's been construed in other cases about incidental to, you have nothing to expand it beyond?
I don't, Your Honor, no. Mm-hmm. No.
While you're up here, I know you're out of time, but we don't let that bother us any.
Actually, I'm not out of time, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I am.
You're
yes.
out of time.
Forgive me.
But on
Forgive
my
me,
time,
it's going along so quickly.
On my
Thank
time,
you.
If we could move to page 14 of the JA, the discussion of the Bright House and Comcast affiliated competitive carriers?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does the Commission get them to be carriers and be consistent with its prior definitions of what a carrier is? In the past, the Commission has treated common carriers as carriers, and these are not common carriers, are they?
Well, the definition of common carriage involves holding out.
Yeah.
And
these are dealing only with, these are captive entities, aren't they?
Well, they at present, they are only providing service to their affiliates. Mm-hmm. But what the Commission found was that these companies had obtained state certificates of public convenience in various states, which authorizes them to act as common carriers, to provide service on a common carrier basis.
They could become common.
Yeah. And
could become common carriers.
Yes,
but that's different than saying they are common carriers.
And in addition, they have interconnection agreements with Verizon. Those are published, making it clear to everyone out there that they are providing these kinds of services. And in addition, they certified to the FCC, and there was no contrary evidence to this effect. They certified to the FCC. That they do hold themselves out and
where,
make
where
this the self-certification.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I understand. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, it's described in paragraph 39.
Okay. You
take all of that evidence together, And the fact that there was no contrary evidence produced by Verizon showing that they were not common carriers or refuting the self-certification, and it was reasonable for the commission to determine by the preponderance of the evidence that they were common carriers. It's important to keep in mind, Your Honors, that common carriage sometimes can apply even when a service is of use to only a tiny fraction of the public.
Yeah, but you still would have a holding out to that fraction.
You have a holding out.
I don't see any public holding out.
I think what the commission said was that the fact that they had gotten these state certificates and entered into interconnection agreements effectively served notice to their relevant public that they were offering service. If you look at footnote 98 of the order on page JA-16, the commission discusses this in the first sentence. The segment of the public to which the Comcast and Bright House competitive carriers seek to provide telecommunications consists of sophisticated entities, other carriers, knowledgeable about state regulatory processes, and the ramifications of state certificates and interconnection agreements. So the idea being that by being out there in the marketplace, by having acquired these state certificates and entered into these agreements with Verizon.
Did the commission ever, maybe they never had a parallel question, but have they ever had a parallel decision holding an entity to be a carrier on that kind of evidence without any holding out?
Well, again, Your Honor, it depends on how you define holding out.
I think you know what I'm asking.
Well,
what's the closest case in which they ever held something to be a carrier?
I don't believe that the commission has found on facts like this before, but I don't think it was presented with facts like this before. So I don't think it's I don't really think it's inconsistent with prior precedent in this area.
Okay, I've imposed on everybody's time.
Well, I have a couple of questions.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
We get into this only to the extent that the First Amendment becomes applicable, but the policy purpose of the commission in this, the current order talks about competition, seems to acknowledge that Verizon's doing this is in the short run pro-competitive, but then there is some long run anti-competitive effect, and what is that?
I think, Your Honor, you expressed it well when you talked about not being able to serve two masters.
That's not competition. That's a different thing. At least I classify that as a conflict problem.
Fair enough, but I think it can affect competition, and let me explain how. I think the concern was that Verizon could, or no receiving carrier in this context, could efficiently and promptly perform these sorts of carrier change requests if it also had the incentive and opportunity to use this proprietary information to engage in retention marketing.
Dawdling by the receiving carrier would be a violation of the Act, right?
It would, and I think the problem is, and Verizon is very careful to say that to this point its performance has been exemplary, it doesn't delay.
The commission contest that?
Well, there is record evidence that that Verizon has had some problems with its execution of number ports. It's actually in the supplemental appendix, which is under seal, appropriately enough, because it involves proprietary information of Verizon, but which I won't disclose. But essentially, it
could you give me a page number?
Pages 60 through 62, essentially, and the interveners discuss this. The cable interveners discuss this on page 6 of their brief. There have been some instances where Verizon has canceled number porting orders for customers who have spurned their retention marketing offers. There are also some instances where a customer is approached by Verizon. It initially says, He initially says, I'll take your offer, your retention marketing offer, then reconsiders, wants to go back to, let's say, Comcast. By that point, the number porting, the original number porting request has been canceled. Verizon has entered a new service request for its existing customer. So when Comcast goes back and submits another number porting request, there is an additional delay. It was reasonable for Congress and the Commission to believe that if you had this situation where the possibility of retention marketing on the basis of this proprietary information was available, that there would be greater incentives for carriers to slow roll or delay or disrupt the process to give those carriers more time to lure those customers back. And that's going to hurt the customers who don't want to have anything to do with the retention market, who just want their number ported. Everybody's going to be harmed by that.
Is that, if the First Amendment is at play, is that a sufficient reason for invasion of First Amendment rights, that while they're talking about it, they might be doing something else wrong? Giving them time to exercise, giving them a chance to exercise their free speech rights means that they might do something wrong in order to get more time within which to exercise their First Amendment rights. Is that your argument?
Well, Your Honor, it's not quite that simple. I would argue that there is a long tradition in the courts of upholding against First Amendment challenges regulations that protect misuse of proprietary or sensitive information.
Fine. Once we get past that, is it your argument that here it is to be regulated because letting them use their First Amendment rights gives them an incentive to do something else wrong?
Well,
I think that's what I heard your argument being.
What it does is it disrupts the carrier change process, which is essential to have an efficient.
It gives the customer a chance to disrupt the carrier change process.
Unless
your argument is that you should infringe their First Amendment rights, if the First Amendment right is infringed, that it can be infringed because allowing them to exercise their First Amendment rights gives them an incentive to dawdle illegally.
Let me put it this way. Let me analogize this to a statute where the court upheld against a First Amendment challenge a restriction on the Bell companies. It's the Bell South case from 1998 involving Section 274 of the Act, where Congress required that if the Bell companies were going to get into electronic publishing, they had to do so through a separate subsidiary. Judge Williams, you wrote the opinion, and Judge Sentelle, you joined that part of the opinion.
And dissented on another ground.
And dissented on another part, that's right, which isn't relevant here. But
this is not an ex post facto violation. Like
No, Your Honor, it is not. But in any event, Judge Williams, in your opinion, you recognized there was an argument being made that there could have been a lesser protection, non-structural safeguards to guard against. In the same way that here it could be argued that you could put restrictions on the amount of time it takes to port a number. But it was reasonable.
There are, and
there's some discussion about possibly tightening those restrictions. But the point is that the cleaner, neater approach in the electronic publishing area was to just have a separate subsidiary, because that, in Congress's judgment, was the most effective way to get at this problem. And by analogy, the most effective way to get at this problem here is to focus the carrier's attention on completing the carrier change. I think it's important to note that this market is like no other. You don't have a retention marketing situation in other markets where a competitor is required to come to the customer's existing carrier and say, I need your help to take your customer from you. It's a crazy system in a way, but it's what needs to be done in this unique network system.
As I understand it, the background is that the customer never, and I guess cannot effectively achieve the LNP by a direct conversation with the current carrier.
That's right, Your Honor.
Why is that?
Well, what happened was about 10 years ago, an industry task force got together and designed this system and made it a carrier-to-carrier transaction. And by the way, that industry task force, if you go to, I think it's the second number portability orders back in 1997, that industry task force included, among others, Bell Atlantic and GTE, which of course later merged to form Verizon. So it was the industry that decided. I don't know all the reasons. I'm assuming that there was some concern about the need for coordination, and it just made sense for the carrier to make the request. And talking about this as just purely a retail service is really quite misleading, because the request is made by the carrier on one of these local service request forms, which is the same form that a carrier would use to request resale, unbundled network elements, other wholesale services.
The form come out of this industry.
I don't know if it came out of this industry colloquy. I think it's a general form that the industry has adopted, and Verizon's wholesale arm, Verizon Partner Solutions, is the one that processes these number porting requests. So even Verizon seems to be treating this as at least in part a wholesale service.
Well, you run into the danger that sometimes happens. While we were pursuing that line, I thought of a little more I wanted to ask.
I'll stay up here as long as I need to, Your Honor.
Carriers. Isn't paragraph 41 pretty much of an admission that this is a departure from prior definitional treatment of carrier?
No, Your Honor. I think that lengthy discussion is nothing more than dicta. It is. I mean, it doesn't resolve anything.
Seems to be saying, on this one particular set of facts, we're going to use a different definition than we've used in the past. Otherwise,
no.
The paragraph, it's not only dicta, it's a nonsensical dicta? Or is it?
Well, it may well be, and that will be the next case. Whatever it is, it's not really relevant to the decision here.
Well, I mean, I'm not so sure that it's not relevant.
Okay.
I mean, it's perfectly fair to say that, for example, this court and other courts will say, well, we interpret such and such a word in such and such context to mean X, and maybe it would mean something different in another context. But that's perhaps not the court in its best moments. Maybe in its best moments it says, well, but there's a possibility that it would produce really odd results if it were interpreted that way in another context. So we ought to think about this really carefully. Can we justify different interpretations in different contexts? You haven't answered that question. Or will we go? Or will we apply this interpretation in the other context? I mean, that seems to be sort of the ideal judicial handling of that situation. And the commission just threw it aside.
Well,
isn't that a fair characterization? I mean, as I start out by saying you haven't acted any worse than the court sometimes does. But
well, that's that'll be a relief to the commission.
I guess you don't even seem worried by it.
I'm not going to get into
that.
I still think there's nothing to indicate that the commission would have reached a different outcome here if it believed that somehow its interpretation would be binding across the board, that it would mean that these carriers were telecommunications carriers.
That's just saying it assumed that it was perfectly legitimate to adopt different interpretations.
Yes. More than assume. Therefore,
well,
we believe it may be permissible to interpret.
It may be permissible.
The last sentence of that paragraph, therefore we believe that it may be permissible to interpret an ambiguous defined term differently in different statutory provisions that serve distinct purposes, seems to be saying we define it differently. If you go back up a few sentences, they say on these particular facts, we stress that we're not deciding any case but this one. It may be all right to do what they're doing, but, counsel, I don't see how you can avoid admitting that they're using a different definition than they've used for the same term in other sections of the same statute.
My life would be a lot easier if this paragraph had stopped after the first sentence. But I don't really think that the rest of this paragraph is particularly relevant. I think this was an inartful way of the commission saying we're deciding the issue before us, which, after all, is what agencies and courts are supposed to do. And the rest of it is dicta. And
although Chevron is what we're mainly talking about deferring under here, this is also an APA question.
It is.
They can't act arbitrarily and capriciously. And we've said lots of times, other courts have too, that the essence of arbitrariness is to apply a different rule in a single case. And you can do it if you explain why you're departing, but I'm not sure that I understand fully why they're departing.
Except that the commission hasn't really said that it's departing here either. I mean, it's...
Comes close.
It hasn't really resolved much of anything with the rest of this rather rambling discourse in paragraph 41. I hope I'm not going to get in trouble with my bosses about that.
I too, want to follow up on one more thing with you. I want to be sure I understand your 222B argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
You see the ambiguity in the statute in the phrase any, right? For purposes of providing any telecommunication service?
Any telecommunication service.
That's where you think the ambiguity comes from.
I think that's a part of it. It doesn't indicate
where else?
It doesn't indicate who is providing that service or
where
who is
else?
Receiving that service. That's the key phrase.
Uh-huh. For purposes of providing any telecommunication service. So you think that can be properly read to include a service not provided by the subject of the sentence, any telecommunication service.
That's correct, because the information is submitted by that carrier for purposes of providing the service, and the receiving carrier is acting in a way that furthers the purposes of providing a service. It's just not that the receiving carrier is providing the service. It's essentially a way of saying the information is going to be used for the purpose for which it was submitted.
If Congress had meant that, wouldn't it have said it's already mentioned in the sentence? It's referred to the telecommunications carrier, okay, that receives it, and then it's referred to from another carrier. And if it had meant what you think it meant, wouldn't it have said for purposes of providing any telecommunications service by either carrier?
It could have said that, Your Honor. But as Justice Scalia said long ago, the 1996 Telecommunications Act is a model of ambiguity.
Well, but the only
question,
it was not the
clearest statute ever written. Pardon me, Your Honor?
This is the sentence we're focusing on.
Yes, I understand, and I think they could have.
Justice Scalia was referring to this.
No, he wasn't.
Okay.
But
let's talk about this phrase, okay?
But the point is that yes, it might have made itself clearer. It also, I suppose, if it wanted to limit this to the wholesale context, as Verizon is arguing, it could have used the word wholesale or could have limited it to the submitting carrier. The statute is ambiguous. It leaves out some language that probably could have been helpful in interpreting the statute. But the commission has done a reasonable job of interpreting a statute that just isn't entirely clear. Yes, Your Honor.
Risk of repetition. I just want to make sure I think I understood you to say that essentially in its basic application, the information we're talking about, information provided to a non-facilities-based provider for the purposes of that provider's providing telecommunication services, right? We're not talking about the network elements that the receiving carrier provides.
If you're talking about in the network elements context,
I think that is the core.
And my argument was it could be one of two things: either the unbundled network element is is an adjunct to a telecommunications service provided by the receiving carrier, or it is the submitting carrier using the network element to provide its own telecommunications service.
Its core application, this provision requires something of a little tweaking, right? Either in the form of this, to me, very awkward notion that it's some other carrier than the receiving carrier, or that it's less than all of telecommunications service.
I think it does need some tweaking. It's not entirely clear to me, too, Your Honor. I know you described the network element situation as the core situation.
Is that not right?
It would certainly be one situation, but I mean, reading the statute doesn't just speaks generally about proprietary information that is exchanged between carriers.
From your policy argument,
I think it's certainly within the ballpark. I don't question that. I'm just saying I don't think you can necessarily look at that as being the only circumstance where
no,
it applies by any means, like or necessarily even the primary.
Thank you.
Kept you up here nearly a half hour past your time, which is probably not a record, but it stands you well among your peers.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate
your indulgence.
Unless
you have a seat at last and hear from the intervener.
May it please the court. I'd like to start, if I could, with the statutory question of the meaning of for purposes of providing any telecommunications service. I do think that there is a very straight, if the court does think that the receiving carrier must be providing the telecommunications service, and I do want to discuss that, but if the court does read the statute as invariably requiring that interpretation, I think paragraph 32 of the order explains how it is satisfied. Paragraph 32 says that that local number portability is an indispensable adjunct to providing interconnection, which is a telecommunications service that the receiving carrier provides to the requesting carrier. Now, in its reply brief, Verizon has suggested no, that service is only a service that Verizon provides to its own customers to allow them to make calls to and receive calls from the other carrier. But that's not correct. Interconnection is mutual. It allows the submitting carrier's customers to make calls to and receive calls from the receiving carrier, and therefore it is a telecommunications service provided to the submitting carrier. I do think that's exactly what paragraph 32 says, in that it specifically refers to local number portability being an indispensable adjunct to interconnection services. I think it's exactly what the order is talking about. It's clearly correct, seems to me to resolve that issue. Now, but moving to the question of whether it can be a service provided by the submitting carrier, there are two points I would like to make. And the first one, Judge Williams, I want to try to pick up on the line of inquiry you were making. It seems to me that there is, if Verizon's interpretation of the statute is the only permissible interpretation of the statute, there's a very significant anomaly there. Leasing an unbundled element to another carrier, leasing a local loop to a competitive carrier, is not providing a telecommunications service. It is not providing transmission for a fee. It is a lease of a facility. Therefore, if the carrier receiving the information must be providing a telecommunications service to the carrier submitting the information, that whole realm of activity is cut out of the statute, and what Your Honor called the heartland of the statute falls away into the sea. There's nothing left of the statute if that's what it means, except pure resellers would get the benefit of the statute and nobody else. It's almost impossible to believe that's what Congress could have intended here when it wrote this statute, and indeed, it does seem to me that using the normal tools of statutory construction under Chevron, including looking to the statute's purpose, the purpose of this statute is to protect the submitting carrier, not the receiving carrier. And to read this statute is to apply only to the tiniest subset of submitting carriers and to provide virtually no protection at all to what Your Honor correctly referred to as the heartland of initial competition just is not a sensible reading of the statute. It can't be what Congress intended here. So with respect to that issue, I do agree, Judge Tatel, you have to read a lot into the phrase any telecommunications service, but I think one can. It's either a telecommunications service that the submitting carrier provides or one that the receiving carrier provides, and that really is the only way to make sense of the statute. Now, with respect to the question of whether there is carrier proprietary information here at stake and whether there's a First Amendment issue here of any consequence, I do think it's important to focus on what the proprietary nature of this information is. It's not the fact that the customer has a desire to switch carriers or keep its phone number. It's the fact that the submitting carrier is forced by virtue of the need here, the need for forced competition, to tell its competitor in advance that, well, I have won the following customers of yours over, and they are going to switch to me a few days from now. That is information that no competitor in a market of any kind would ever voluntarily convey to its competitor. It would never happen. It's proprietary information. And I think the reason why the statute can't be read to draw the wholesale retail line that Verizon insists it should be drawn here is because the proprietary character of that information does not arise. It arises not from the fact that there's a wholesale retail relationship. It arises from the fact that these entities are retail competitors. They're retail competitors in the unbundled elements and resale situation. They're retail competitors in the facilities-based situation. It's exactly the same in both. And therefore, the interest that allows this statute to apply and apply constitutionally with respect to resale and unbundled element competitors, as Verizon concedes it does, is exactly the same interest that allows it to apply constitutionally with respect to facilities-based competitors.
Unless my colleagues have questions, we're over your time now, counsel.
Chief Judge Santel, if I could just answer a couple of specific questions you asked about intervener status. With respect to this question of whether the interveners are holding out, of course, that doesn't apply to Time Warner Cable.
Yeah.
With respect to Comcast, at the time of these proceedings, Comcast had a proposed tariff in place in Pennsylvania. Since the proceedings, Comcast has actual tariffs in place in all the jurisdictions where it operates. That's, of course, not in the record, but a matter of public record because they're tariffs. So there's no doubt about holding out, I don't think. With respect to the other question that you asked, Your Honor, about the FCC's effort to reserve the question of whether these are telecommunications carriers for all purposes, the FCC can figure out whatever it wants to figure out about that. It has no bearing on this case because in the record, all of these carriers acknowledge that they are and are willing to be treated as common carriers for all purposes. Therefore, no matter how the FCC resolves that question, it doesn't affect the outcome
Thank
of the
you,
case.
Counsel.
Thank you.
How much time left for rebuttal? 2 minutes, okay. Mr. Kellogg?
Thank you, Judge Sintel. I think it's very telling that Mr. Carr's rationale for the way the FCC interprets this restriction is the can't serve two masters point, which you will not find in the FCC's order. Indeed,
well, you find it by a cross-reference to the 1998 anti-slamming order.
In a different context. What the FCC says in paragraph 27 quite specifically is that the reason they're interpreting this provision the way they are is in furtherance of their policy of promoting facilities-based competition. Yet they cannot explain how, in fact, this promotes facilities-based competition, a context in which the gloves are off, and they've acknowledged that there's short-term benefits of allowing Verizon to do this. They've acknowledged that consumers are going to be paying super competitive prices if Verizon's not allowed to do this. And this is exactly why the FCC gets into trouble on paragraph 41 in the definition of carriers. Because here we're dealing with a context where it's only a facilities-based carrier. They don't buy unbundled elements from us or uni-loops. They're pure facilities-based competition. Comcast and Bright House are solely wholesalers for their own retail operations. They are not carriers under the definition of the statute. They do not provide service to anybody other than their own affiliates. And
what
so the FCC.
What do you say about the Pennsylvania tariff and other tariffs?
You know, I have no reason to, I'm sure it's correct if Mr. Verli has represented it as such. It's not in the record in this case. It's not the basis for the FCC's decision. Their basis is, well, we're going to interpret it this way in the context of 222 because of our policy of promoting facilities-based competition, by which they mean preventing consumers from getting information that would convince them to switch back to us, or rather to stay with us rather than to change to them. The final point I would make, to the extent that there's ambiguity, as this court has made clear, that the canon of constitutional avoidance does trump Chevron.
But what is your is that your answer to the question about whether the word any creates an ambiguity? Are you conceding that it does?
The word any does not create an ambiguity on the first point I made, which is that it has to be us providing any telecommunications.
And why not? Tell me why not. It does say any telecommunication service, any telecommunication service.
Right.
What is it that unambiguously links that phrase to your client, as opposed to
the fact that we're the subject of the sentence, as you yourself
pointed
out?
Well, but that doesn't. I don't think that gets you there, because it says, remember, I'm only asking the question about whether it's ambiguous. That's all, not whether it clearly supports the FCC's view. It says for purposes of providing any telecommunication service.
Right, and the word any is unambiguous, that every and any and each telecommunication service that we might provide is covered by 222B, but it still has to be us who are providing that service.
Why?
Because of the words, for purposes of providing any telecommunications, shall use such information only for such purpose. Who's using it? We're using it, the telecommunications carrier, and we're providing. So I don't think there's any ambiguity there.
Mr. Kellogg, what is your reaction to the proposition that emerged from Mr. Carr that combination of Mr. Carr and Mr. Verli, that the literal reading, which of course is what we're normally supposed to do, literal reading would confine the statute to the case of resellers of communication service being provided by the receiving carrier?
I'm very glad you asked that, because there's nothing in the FCC's order at issue here to suggest that that would be the case. To suggest
I'm just wondering how we would get to that case under a sort of, I would argue, grammatically pure reading of the provision.
Well, if we're providing a uni loop to another carrier, what we're providing in that uni loop is point-to-point transportation of information of their using. Now, if the FCC in another context is going to decide that that's not a telecommunications service,
it seems to me what you've just said is you're providing a component that is necessary for someone else, in fact, to provide telecommunications service as defined in the Act.
No, because wholesale provision of telecommunications service is still a telecommunications service, even though they're using that as part of a retail telecommunications service. There's nothing in this order.
Availability of a loop is itself a telecommunications service?
Well, I don't think that's been resolved in this order. There's nothing to suggest, nor would there be, because the complainants at issue here are pure facilities-based carriers.
I understand that. But,
certainly,
at least my understanding is that the argument by the commission, I don't think you responded on this aspect of it, was that does cover the carrier who's using unbundled elements from the incumbent carrier, and therefore to cover the facilities-based calendar, the carrier as a matter of policy and logic, And I don't think you responded saying, no, no, it doesn't even cover the unbundled element provider. Where the receiving carrier is providing an unbundled element.
Well, if we are providing to the other carrier something, then like wholesale service, or even I would suggest an unbundled loop, then it fits within the general language.
If it could be broken down to an unbundled loop, I don't honestly see why it can't be broken down to providing whatever is necessary for the LNP process.
Because the LNP process is something that we do as part of our own retail responsibilities to our own customers. It is not a wholesale obligation imposed.
The word wholesale is not in the statute.
I'm sorry?
The word wholesale is not in 222B.
That's absolutely correct. But if you look at the structure of the statute, B covers information we get from other carriers. C covers CPNI, customer proprietary network information, which is at issue. What is at issue here? The port request by statute is defined as a request by the user under the NANSI rules, the North American Numbering Subcommittee that Mr. Carr referred to. The other carrier acts only as the agent of the user, and indeed, the statement of stipulated facts, if you look at JA 226, it is the customer's port request. That is customary proprietary network information, and it's well established that we are entitled to use that in retention marketing.
Okay. Well, once again, we've taken you also well beyond your time, so unless my colleagues have questions, the case is submitted.
Thank you.